Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Two Cups of Tea. Today, I've travelled to Nottingham, and I'm here to meet Janet. She grew up in the Welsh Valleys and became a successful teacher and academic. Many years ago, she underwent gender reassignment to become the woman she always knew that she was. Today, she talks with fondness of her happy childhood as a young boy in Wales and the long, often emotional journey over the years that followed. Right then, I'll go and set up the microphones. You listen to the theme tune. Let's go.
I was born in South Wales in the South Wales Valleys, 1949. I'd worked out, actually, which is interesting. I must have been conceived when the NHS was conceived, so that would have made me one of the first batch of babies born in the NHS.
And where was that?
That was a small cottage hospital in a village called Pot of the Rhondda, which was called Llwyn y Pier.
I'm not even going to try that one if you don't mind.
Won't.
Won't be pretty.
Yeah.
So tell me about the makeup of the family that you were born into.
There was my mum and dad, and they, which was quite common in those days, which is similar today. They lived with my mum's mother, who had a big rented house in Treorchy. And so my grandmother, my mother's mother, lived upstairs. And me and my mother and father lived downstairs. And then there was three floors to this house. We lived on the ground floor, my grandmother in the middle floor. And I actually slept in the attic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Also living there, various people came because my grandmother had a big family. She had seven children. She was widowed after the war. And so at various times, perhaps one of her children would pop in or perhaps spend a few weeks there or something.
Yeah.
Most of the time it was me, my mother, my father, and my grandmother had a lodger. Who I called Uncle Phil.
Uncle Phil?
Mm.
Uncle
Phil was an Irishman who came from County Waterford, and he had worked, like a lot of Irishmen who came into South Wales, manual worker, and he had retired and he rented a room, I was young then.
In the house with you?
Well, it was a big house, it had about 13 and 14 rooms.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was he just like a part of the furniture,
he was part of the furniture. And then a very interesting thing happened. I remember going with my grandmother to a mental health hospital in Bridgend.
Right.
Because my grandmother had a friend in there called Celia. And Celia had been incarcerated there. It was all lock and key.
As in against her will?
Yeah. And I don't think there was that much wrong with Celia, to be honest. She might even, might be making this up, but it could possibly have been that she had an illegitimate baby or something like that.
Yeah, that's all too common a tale, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was a way of dealing with problems, wasn't it, rather than...
Yeah. It was quite a horrific place, really.
I can imagine.
But I can remember my grandmother being on a quest to get Celia released. And she succeeded in the end. And Celia also joined the family. And so she lived in my grandmother's house.
Yeah.
My grandmother was quite disabled with arthritis, so Celia helped to look after my grandmother, I suppose.
And yeah.
You know, she did a lot of housework and cleaning, but she had suffered a lot and was very institutionalised.
Yeah.
So that was more or less it, I think.
And tell me about your mum and dad. What was your mum and dad's names?
Lena and Doug, and my mother had rheumatic fever when she was 12 years of age.
Wow.
And that was pre the NHS, so that left her with the disease heart valves, and which she suffered from till she died, actually, at 71 years of age in 1997.
Yeah.
My dad was a general labourer,
yeah,
according to my birth certificate, and he worked in Port Talbot when I was alive. When I was a child, he worked in Port Talbot Steelworks as a scaffolder, and what he did was to work occasionally. They shut down the coke ovens where they made steel, which were huge, you know, about 6 houses high, and a huge cauldron,
yeah,
which were lined with fire bricks. And my dad's job was, with his mates, was to go inside, put scaffolding up so that bricklayers could come and re-line the blast furnaces.
Wow.
So it's quite a horrible environment. And I can remember kind of hush descending on the house when he'd come home from work and one of his mates had fallen off the scaffolding and died, because probably the health and safety in those days was pretty grim.
Yeah.
That happened 2 or 3 times. I can remember that. So
that happened more than once?
Oh, certainly more than once.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah. That took its toll, I think, on my dad, but mainly physically from the dust in the environment.
Oh, I imagine on the lungs, that can't have been...
And he developed later on in life chronic emphysema, which he made him incapable of work when he was about 40.
God.
So I was kind of a benefits child in today's terms, brought upon, you know, sickness benefits.
Yeah.
Because both my mum and my dad were ill.
Were there brothers and sisters?
No, my brother came along. I've got one brother, and he came along about 7 years after I was born. So he's 7 years younger than me. Now, what happened when my brother... I can't remember now. Let's go... I can't remember the exact detail, whether my mother and father bought their own little miner's cottage, two up, two down kind of job.
Yeah.
Either slightly before my brother was born or slightly afterwards. So he actually moved out into our own house.
Oh, okay.
Around that time.
Did you like the big house with all the people?
It was quite traumatic for me personally, because I had quite an affinity with my grandmother. In a sense, my grandmother, who had been used to raising children, kind of adopted me in a sense. So there was me, my mother. So I used to go up and down between the middle floor and the ground floor between my grandmother and my mother. And I did, when we moved out, I did miss, because I was quite close to my grandmother.
Yeah.
I did miss her a lot.
Well, there's a bond, I think, with grandmothers and grandparents that's different anyway to that with the parents. I think it's stronger in some ways.
I've written about this. I've written a story about one of my earliest memory. My grandmother was, to all intents, she had been down in London in the 20s, like I suppose a lot of women, working in what they call service. So she was basically a maid in a big house in London. And family story goes that she was involved in the suffragette movement.
Wow.
But she was certainly a woman of great strength. She was also very politically minded.
Yeah.
She was a member of the Communist Party.
Goodness.
And in fact, when I was 12, when she died, she was officiant at her funeral in our house, in the big house.
Yeah.
Was a woman called Annie Powell, who was a member, the local party official who came, there's a red flag over my grandmother's coffin. And,
right.
She came to do the funeral service. Annie Powell was interesting because she apparently was the only communist mayor in anywhere in Great Britain, in a town called Marty, which was often called Little Moscow.
Little Moscow?
Yeah. So,
goodness me.
But communism in those days, between the wars, was quite prevalent in the UK. Yeah.
No, I can imagine. Did that trickle down to your parents too? Was it just something that...
No, my parents weren't... In fact, my father was a Tory. A working class Tory.
Yeah.
But what it did mean was... there was no religion in the house.
Right.
So, and that was unusual in Truorkee at those days because the chapels and the churches were quite full.
And quite powerful in the community too.
Yeah. So we were outside that. But Close Philip, coming from Ireland, Uncle Phil, was a Catholic. And again, that was unusual because it was a very small Catholic community which were mainly Irish-Italian migrants into the South Wales coalfield. The Irish worked like Phil did in manual jobs, and the Italians set up little businesses, which were usually ice cream parlours and coffee houses, and there were lots of those.
Mm.
And then up near my grandma's house, there was quite a few of those, plus there was Bassini's, which was... fish and chip shop.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a small community, but what was interesting around the Rhondda as well, Rhondda Valley is made up of, like, I described it in the bit I wrote, it's like giant caterpillars straddling the whole of the valley with segments, which would be the different villages.
Yeah.
So you go from one village, you'd run into the next one. There was no gaps, really, in between the villages. And the houses were also like little caterpillars, I suppose, straddling the undulations of the hillsides.
Yeah, clinging on.
They'd follow the contours of the hillsides and they'd wave it like a wave of land right up and down.
Did you like the part of the world you grew up in? Did you like the outdoors?
Well, that was lovely because, particularly when we still lived in Truorkee, I had some friends. We used to go up the farm to play.
Mm.
Play in the haystacks and help clean the horses out. And what was nice then, we'd get a chance to ride on some of the small horses.
Mm.
We also used to go up into the mountains to build dens and build ponds and swim in them. It was, my childhood in that sense was lovely.
Yeah.
The other big thing for me, which was a great shock, was when I was in Truorkee, I went to Truorkee Junior Mixed School, which is boys and girls.
Yeah.
When I went, when my parents moved to another village, which was called Tom Bendra, and I went to the local primary school, which was a boys' school. And I hated that because I was so used to being around girls as well.
So you started at the mixed school and then went to an all boys' school?
Yeah, I think I had quite an early awareness from 4 or 5 years of age that I was a little bit different to the others around me, and I didn't, obviously in those days I didn't have a clue what made me different or what was going on.
Because the one thing I'm conscious that we haven't mentioned is that we're talking about you as a little boy.
Yes, and I always liked helping my grandmother cook, and as I mentioned to you, I think she was disabled, so I helped her to get dressed and that kind of stuff. So, in a way, part of it, I played the role of a little girl as well.
Yeah.
And that's why moving to Tom Pentra, it was a bit of a shock not to have girls around me in school.
You're suddenly at a school with all boys, and it must have...
And the culture was very different. I can remember boys running around the playground playing British and German aeroplanes with their arms out and running around playing fight, dog fights and all that.
Yeah.
The war was, I suppose, the Second World War was still very influential on children's play at that time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But matters got worse then because the 11 plus came along.
Right.
And it seemed to me all the children on the street passed and I failed. And they all went off to grammar schools.
Yeah.
Which most of them went to a mixed grammar school.
Yeah.
I went to a boys' secondary modern. And that wasn't a very pleasant experience. I wasn't bullied. I suppose I was teased a bit because my sporting ability was useless.
Yeah.
And but nothing serious. But I just hated being around, the girls. Well, it was quite common again that the boys' school and the girls' school were adjacent to each other with a fence down the middle.
Oh, really?
So playtime, some of the boys would talk with the girls through the railings of the fence between the two schools.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I could barely read and write, actually, when I went to the secondary modern.
Mm.
But what saved me was I was a genius in that school in terms of maths and science.
Right.
And my form teacher, who ironically was the English teacher, recognised that talent in me. And they had a system in the room then, which was quite good educationally, because about two-thirds of the children went to grammar schools, which was opposite to what England was.
Yeah.
Because education was highly prized in the valleys.
Mm.
It was important, and part of it that was that the aim of most parents was that the children didn't go down the coal mines.
Yeah.
I went to the secondary modern for this first year.
Mm.
And then John Davis, my teacher, English teacher.
After you displayed your genius at maths and science?
Yeah. Well, I was treated in maths. We used to go through the maths book. And the maths teacher was a tyrant, but he ran the classroom like a side, like an old Victorian classroom. You don't breathe or you get your knuckles wrapped.
Yeah.
And every Friday we had a test, and the best would sit at one end, and then the seats would be arranged in order of how you did in the test.
Really, like pole position at the racing.
Yeah, and I was in the top seat. And I was halfway through the second book when the other end of the academic group, or the bottom boys, were struggling on the first few pages of the first book.
Yeah.
Must have been about five or six of us were recommended to go transfer to the grammar school. So I started again in the grammar school. But I had to go into the first year of the grammar school, not the second year. So I was a year behind then, and so were the others. But when I went to the grammar school, my kind of education started to flourish.
Mm.
The comparison, there was no comparison. The resources were better, the teaching was better, it was more purposeful. And I ended up being top of the year every year in the grammar school.
Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny then? I wonder if because if that's something that you were so clearly had the ability to do, it makes you question how effective the 11 plus was.
Oh, totally ineffective as far as life is concerned and my education. I'm going to surprise you now, I've actually got 6 degrees.
Oh my God.
And I failed the 11 plus. I'm sure there's not many people with 6 degrees.
Who failed the 11 plus? Yeah, I think you're probably right. Yeah, I don't think there's many people with 6 degrees, let alone who failed the 11 plus.
Yeah.
Goodness me. Can I ask what they're in?
Yeah, I got 2 first degrees, one in physics and one in maths.
Yeah.
And then I got 2 masters, one in education and one in cultural studies. And I got a postgraduate diploma in counselling and psychotherapy. And I got a doctorate in well, sociology, I'll come on to that later on.
Wow.
So I transferred.
So you know, you are now in the grammar school now?
Yeah. Yeah,
which and was that like, and was that better socially too?
Oh yeah, it was mixed.
And, oh good.
That's when I had my first kind of crush, I suppose, on a girl whose name was Janet.
Ah.
And me and Janet were liked each other a lot, and we used to pass love notes under the desks, and, which we'd write in a simple chord.
Yeah.
And then...
Can you remember what the code was?
Yeah, it was just I'd taken the first letter off, I think, and adding the A-Y to the end.
Ah, so Pig Latin.
Yeah, probably.
So I-A, Ovle, U-Y, Anit-J.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Well, I only did Latin pre-year. But in... My grandmother was still alive then, in that first year, but the other big thing that happened to me, as I told you, I'd been born when the NHS started.
Yes.
And looking back at the NHS in those early days, I think they were a bit trigger happy.
Right.
If you had something wrong with it, you know, they'd give you the works. And
yeah.
I had somewhat flat feet, which made my feet ache a bit. My mother, anyway, ended up having surgery, which meant that I was in hospital, in the local orthopaedic hospital near Cardiff for 6 weeks.
Well, that's a long time.
It was a long time, and even had my teacher, I had a hospital teacher they used to have.
God, wow.
So we had school in hospital.
So what age was this at? This must have been...
I was when I was 12.
Yeah.
Yeah.
6 weeks in hospital when you're 12 must have been like a prison sentence.
Well, no, it wasn't, actually.
Oh, really? You liked it?
I wouldn't say loved it, but it wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
Me and Janet used to write to each other, so that was nice.
Oh, that is nice.
And then I had a crush on one of the young nurses.
Oh, really?
I can still remember her name. It was Nurse Janie.
Did you... I'm presuming you didn't mention that in your letters to Janet?
No, no.
P.S. I really fancy one of the nurses here.
Well, Nurse Jenny used to took a fondness to me, I think. She used to, you know, help me and look after me. And,
yeah.
I'd forgotten about that. Mm. So, anyway, I was in there. Then I came back. But me and Janet never really got anywhere. We never went out or anything like that. It was,
yeah.
It was just a school crush.
Yeah, like an innocent first crush. That's nice.
Yeah. And I was quite young, I was only 12.
Yeah, exactly.
I suppose the next... I had two friends, which I met, two male friends then, who were pals.
Yeah.
Mark and Gareth. And we stayed friends, actually, from then, from when I was 13, 14, right up to when we were about 40.
Wow.
Even though we had... by that time, spread to different parts of the country.
Yeah.
One of the things the three of us had was a culture of competing against each other to try and be the best academically. And that was very strong amongst the three of us.
Mm.
But I always won in maths and science.
Yeah.
And I always ended up, as I told you, top of the year. And Gareth would come sometimes second or third, much to his annoyance.
Yes.
And Mark was a bit further behind us. So then by the third year, I met what turned out to be my wife.
Oh, wow. And so that's when you're 13 or 14?
Yeah.
So it was a proper childhood sweetheart?
Yeah. She was a year older than me, so she was in the next year up.
Oh, okay.
Or 18 months older than me, actually. We stayed together for about... two more years.
Oh, and I see. And then you then rekindled later. Is that
so? That was when I was in the fifth year, and when I went into the sixth form.
Yeah.
Because she was older and but young, young in her year group, she went off to teacher training college.
Right. Okay.
So, I was left kind of bereft a bit.
Yeah, a bit rudderless.
Yeah, but that, when I was starting my A-levels,
yeah.
I'd done quite well, I think. By then I must have had about 10 O-levels. And with good grades.
Yeah.
The teaching in the sixth form turned out to be pretty grim. And
how so?
A combination of poor teaching, I would put it down to A-level teaching,
yeah.
And the fact that I was beginning to get more at sea about my own identity.
Yeah.
And also my love, you know, my love going away. That was a difficult time for me.
Mm.
What was to begin a very, quite a difficult time. Up till then, I'd been okay. Yeah, I'd been quite happy. I was well aware that when puberty came on that I was different.
Yeah.
But again, I couldn't really say what it was.
Mm.
You know what boys are like. In those days, there was a lot of talk about sex.
Yeah.
A lot of boys were in relationships or sexual relationships as well. But there was also an awareness of homosexuality.
Yeah.
And I was the only certainty I had in my life was that I wasn't gay.
Yeah.
But that made me more puzzled. You know, I never fancied, as I told you, I've more or less been in relationships with girls from that fairly early age.
Yeah.
Playing in primary school.
So something you couldn't put your finger on was...
Well, I didn't have a clue what it was.
Yeah.
Except I knew I was attracted to girls, but it was the part of the attraction was I wanted to be like them.
Yeah.
So I then met in the sixth form. We used to walk to school, me and Gareth, and we used to walk past one of the bus stops, and there was this girl with long blonde hair.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, really fancy.
Yeah.
And that began a very loving, intense relationship for 2 years.
Right.
And we were exceedingly... That was probably the most serious love of my life.
Really?
Yeah, in those... Yeah. Yeah, but
I suppose at that age as well, it tends to be. That's when it kind of burns brightest at that age.
Yes, it was very intense.
Yeah.
I remember we sneaked away to London for a holiday together.
Wow. Where did you go? Do you remember?
Yeah, well, I can remember landing in St Pancras, which is at the other end of the train line from Cardiff. And we stayed in a guest house in London. Fried and stiff, doing something terrible. But and we booked separate rooms as well.
Really?
We were so frightened.
Did you? Of course. Did you? Well, she'll have probably guessed. I'm figuring. But did you remember? Did you sightsee and?
I don't think we did very much. I haven't got a clue what we did, and we probably did.
Yeah.
We weren't there long. It's only a few nights.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a big adventure.
Sounds like a big adventure.
A big risky adventure.
Yeah.
That was that, and then I went to university when I'd finished the sixth form in Cardiff.
Where did you go?
Cardiff University.
Oh, Cardiff.
To do physics and pure and applied maths.
And that was the first of your 6 degrees?
Yeah.
Was it what you expected the experience to be like, or was it...
No, that was a big shock to my culture as well. Now, bearing in mind, me and my true love of the the sixth form level.
Yeah.
We split up after 2 terms in Cardiff, like a lot of relationships end.
Yeah.
Because she was younger than me, so she was still in school. I went to university. Yeah. So it mirrored what had happened with my first relationship as well. And when I got to Cardiff, my uncomfortableness with my identity and who I was getting very intense.
Mm.
And I suppose my first year in university, I was the closest in my whole life to becoming an alcoholic.
Really?
I drank very heavily. I did no work, and I got frightened after two terms because I was so far behind my work, and I was drinking quite heavy. I changed actually from applied maths, because I couldn't do it because I hadn't done any of the work, to chemistry. So I did chemistry for a term and passed chemistry.
Right, gotcha.
That was easy. So I then went on to do honours physics, which in the second and third year.
Yeah.
But I came out with a poor degree because I was in turmoil. Yeah, I was trying to work. The relationship had ended. I was struggling with my own identity.
Did you have anyone to confide in?
I never talked to anybody about what I was feeling. I hid it very effectively.
How?
In school, because I was so bright academically, Gareth and Mark, my friends, I kind of latched on to them, and they were typical boys having loads of girlfriends and stuff. So being part of their little group protected me.
So we're at Cardiff. You've not really found anyone to confide in, and this is the most...
But the pressure was building up, and I drank a lot, and as I said, it affected my work horrifically.
Yeah.
Then my first girlfriend came back on the scene, or we sought each other out.
Yes.
The feelings entirely died. And when I left Cardiff, we got back together.
Yeah.
And we got married after... I left Cardiff in June and we got married in December.
Mm.
In the meanwhile, she was teaching in Bristol. She'd done a year and a half or 2 years teaching in Bristol. And she came home to the... I got a job. Well, let me tell you about that. I came out to Cardiff University with a poor degree in 1971. Now, any degree in physics would, up to then, where I could have walked into dozens of jobs. Word must have got about the village. I was back home with Mum. The school, my girlfriend's brother taught at the school, so they must have spread the word that I was around with a degree in physics, and they've always been short of science teachers.
Mm.
So I got a message, would I come and take a job in the local comprehensive school? But I didn't want to be a teacher. That was the last thing on earth I wanted to be as a teacher. But I went up and saw the head teacher, and he offered me the job. So I walked into school and started teaching without any training whatsoever.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And then being back in the Rhondda, having got married, all our family around us, I saw a good job advertised in Cheshire. And my wife had come back from Bristol when we got married, and she got a primary school job in Treorchy. I saw this good job advertised second in the physics department in a comprehensive school in Mid-Cheshire.
Yeah.
And I thought, that looks interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So I applied and I was interviewed and got the job. Anyway, we weren't there very long, but our first two children were born, my eldest two sons.
Yeah.
And then there was a really good job, the best job I ever had, in Radcliffe on Trent.
Right.
As head of science. So at 28, I think I was then.
Yeah.
The family, we all moved over to Radcliffe. The head was good that I ran the department. I had total free rein how to do it.
Brilliant.
And as I said, I taught tough kids in Cheshire, so I could, it was a bit of a, easy piece.
Yeah, similar like Radcliffe on Trent, I imagine it was
and
the.
Cotgrave, yeah.
Yeah.
Even though, and probably that's why I was brought in because of my experience coming from South Wales.
It must have been like a walk in the park after.
It was. But I really started to motor professionally, and we had a brilliant department. It was well known in the East Midlands. You had university students come in just to observe our teaching in science. But I made the biggest professional mistake in my life then. I must have got too big for my boots, because I ended up getting a deputy headship in a rubbish school. I thought, I can change this.
Right.
But I couldn't. I learned a lot in the first 5 years, and I grew a lot, and then it became a chore then. But when we moved to Nottingham, concurrent with all that professional stuff, my gender identity was beginning to cause problems. And that's partly why I work so hard, I think.
Mm.
I was working 70 hours a week then to drive away the distress a bit of.
Yeah.
I started to explore more seriously then, and I was in counselling for a year, and I realised that I was suffering gender dysphoria, which meant, in simple terms, even though I appeared a man, inside my brain and my identity was female.
Yeah.
But I was lucky I had the help of another trans person in Cardiff University in the medical school, who kind of facilitated and pointed me in the right direction. I ended up in Charing Cross Hospital in London. And that began my transition to female, which took 15 years, but I was in my mid-30s then. By that time, we'd had four children, so I was working on five cylinders, in a sense. I had a big responsibility in my job. I had quite a big young family.
Yeah.
It was quite a strainful time.
I'm sure. How did you first address it with your wife?
Well, I think all the time we were married, even going back to school, she realised that there was something odd with me and different.
Yeah. So it wasn't a bombshell?
No. We lived with it. I suppose as my need to change, what we call transition, from male to female, grew stronger, it became more difficult in the family.
Sure.
So when I actually, I suppose the one ironic equation was my parents didn't know, because we lived in Nottingham and they were still down in Wales.
Yes.
But they were getting quite frail by that time.
Sure.
And as I told you, they were both ill.
Yeah.
They were 71 by that time. I remember my gender transition had come to the point that I needed to have surgery. On the day I was booked in for surgery in Leicester, was the day of my dad's funeral.
Really?
So obviously I had to cancel that and go down to Wales. But I lived a double life as well, half my time as a man and half my time as up to that point. I'd finished teaching in 1992.
So at this point, were your children aware?
Yeah, well, they were like my spouse, really.
Yes, and so every it was this
in the house. They knew I was different.
Yeah,
yeah.
What year?
We were in the mid-90s then, mid-late 90s.
But considering how far things have come in terms of awareness and recognition, and
yeah,
you know, the mid-90s was still.
It was still archaic
in terms of attitudes to.
Well, there was no legislation in place to protect trans people,
yeah.
So you could be discriminated against, and that's how I left teaching. The local authority. Well, I approached the trade union, National Union Teachers, confidentially. I approached the regional office because I was a senior member of.
Yeah.
By that time I was running the secondary school.
Yeah.
So I approached the regional office of the NUT, and was brilliantly helpful.
Really.
But didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
Because I'd not come across this before. I'd also was in contact with some other trans people in the south of England.
And yeah.
I met a couple of times. A primary school head who was in the same situation.
Right.
Were the National Association of Head Teachers was helping him. So I mentioned this to the NUT region. So they all, actually, the two unions worked together to help me. Oh, all sorts of things went awry because the local authority, the trade union, were trying to help me. And the plan was that I could leave the school, go into local authority administration. Mm. Transition and come back into teaching afterwards.
Yeah.
And it got all sorts of messy. You can imagine if the school had been aware of that transition, it would have got to the media and it would have been all over the national media. Well, it happened to a trans friend of mine who I was quite friendly with, who got, she transitioned and got, she was a vicar actually.
Yeah.
And, one day it was splashed all over the sex change vicar.
Well, it's mother's milk to a certain kind of tabloid headline writer, something like that,
well,
isn't it?
Right, it would have been sex change head teacher.
Yeah.
So what we all came to the conclusion was they parked me really, and at 42 years of age, ironically the same age as more or less my dad.
Yeah.
I finished work and I was put on incapacity benefit and teacher's infirmity pension for the rest of my life.
Really?
Yeah.
So what was next?
I'd left teaching, my parents died, and then 2 years later I transitioned.
Yeah.
But things were getting tough in the family, and I separated, and we separated. I moved out into the city in a flat,
yeah,
on my own, which I suppose was the start of my loneliness, really, because I'd always lived in a family, in a big family.
And now you were
on my own,
yeah,
as a woman,
yeah,
trying to build a new life on my own, which was pretty challenging.
What were your days filled with? It was the academia.
I've always done a lot of voluntary work. So
yeah.
Since I finished teaching.
Yeah.
I worked for, I was the chair of an advice centre. I worked in the Citizens Advice Bureau as
yeah.
a volunteer. I was a director of Relate. I did lots of things.
Yeah, sure.
I was quite... Part of it in my mind, I thought, okay, I'm getting paid by the state.
Mm.
So
you felt you needed to give something back.
I was very skilled and qualified.
Yeah.
I put back, you know, I was given my time freely.
Mm.
And even now I'm kind of nearly working full time, even though I was supposed to have retired.
Yeah.
So I've always, but personally in my heart, I've been lonely. Yeah.
How do you deal with
well,
loneliness?
One of the first things when I transitioned, I can remember lying in the hospital bed in Leicester thinking, ah, so what's going to happen to my relationships? Am I going to be in relationships with men or women? Because I'd always had relationships with women,
yeah.
Heterosexual. And I was lying there, and I came up with about 10 permutations, I thought. I put that aside. I didn't, obviously couldn't resolve that lying in my hospital bed.
Yeah.
I remember when I was doing some voluntary work, I met a lesbian and I was talking to her about it. And she said, well, when you're walking down the street, who do you fancy, men or women? I said, women. She said, well, that's the end of it. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Immediately our marriage broke up, I sought solace in the church.
Yeah.
And I won't go into a lot of details there, but I went back to an Anglican church, which, contrary to what's popular kind of understandings, the congregation were absolutely beautiful.
Oh, really?
They saved my life on many occasions.
Oh, that's wonderful.
They took me into their arms and they cherished me. I was very vulnerable week when I went there.
Yeah.
And, I can't fault them. They were so lovely.
Oh, that is wonderful to hear.
And then I got friends with a group of about half a dozen women who were mainly widows and stuff. And we used to go on holidays together. Anyway, I went on one holiday and out of that came a lesbian relationship with one of them, and which lasted 3 months, but it wasn't serious. But it was nice to be reaffirmed. Or for me to have some sort of
intimacy and some, you know, some just
bearing on my sexuality.
Yeah.
And about 2005, 2006, I met this woman.
Yeah.
I was introduced to a woman, much younger than me, by a mutual friend.
Yeah.
And we ended up having a 10-year loving relationship again.
Oh, which really?
I would describe was as loving as the one I had when I was in my sixth form.
Really?
And that was beautiful. That was lovely. But we split up in the end.
That can't have been too long ago.
Hmm?
That.
No, we split up, 2.5 years ago now. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
The other kind of way I've dealt with, I've survived. Yeah, I'm a survivor. I've survived very well. I suppose I've got a happy life. I do. I've got lots of friends. I do loads of things. I'm busy all the time. I carried on going to that Anglican church. The desire to be ordained again, but this time as a woman, re-emerged.
Yeah.
But the bishop didn't like that, so that was the end of that. And I couldn't do anything about that. So when the vicar and the curate left, I decided I'd leave at the same time.
Yeah.
And I became a Catholic nearly 4 years ago now.
Sure.
Both my faith and my self-understanding psychologically has taught me to live life happily and as best I got with what I got.
And I think
and currently, I'll let you into a secret. I'm in love with another woman, but it's a bit slow.
Let's good luck with that. I'll keep my fingers crossed for you. Is there one life lesson that sticks out above any others that you've learned along the way?
If you want to do something, do it. You've got to do it. You only get one life.
Well, it's hard to argue with that.
And, lots of people don't.
Yeah.
I meet lots of people. I find the people I get into difficulty with are people who've not done that.
And that was Janet. She was fantastically inspirational to talk to and a pleasure to spend time with. As you'll have just heard, this podcast is about sharing some fantastic life stories, but there are well over 1 million chronically lonely people in the UK who have no one to share their stories with. If you'd like to know more about ways to change this, then please go online and visit campaigntoendloneliness.org and find out how together we can make loneliness a thing of the past. Thanks again to Janet, and also thanks to Acast for hosting this show. See you next time.
The secret to summer-ready skin is here. Osea's number one best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil, clinically proven to instantly improve skin elasticity and transform dry skin to silky, soft, and unbelievably glowing. Its signature scent of freshly squeezed grapefruit, cypress, and mango mandarin transports you to sun-kissed summer days. Get healthy, glowing skin for summer with clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.